Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm Travis, your fearless podcast host, and we're going to dive headfirst into a lot of listener questions today. There's on a variety of topics, a lot of stuff going on in the news, a lot of stuff that I think will interest you. So let's just kick it off, and I've got like seven to get through today, I think. Here's number one.
Hi, my name is Susan. I have an old FFELP, joint spousal consolidation loan. We do not qualify for the October 6th waiver, nor did we qualify for the COVID pause. We have been paying $810 a month all during this time. We need somebody to speak up for us now. We consolidated our loans back in 1996, thinking that we were saving 1% interest, not knowing that it would make us not eligible for any of the programs. We were lied to, taken advantage of. We borrowed $26,000. We've paid over $90,000, and we still owe $87,000 interest at 9%. Help us.
First of all, I feel the listener's pain. This is really frustrating. The spousal consolidation loan, for those of you that don't know, is a defunct loan program that was around 10 to 20 years ago, where you could combine your loans with your spouse's loans. In the case of people's marriages staying intact, then that's still really difficult because you can't get access to PSLF easily. You can't get access to income-based repayment forgiveness easily. It's just a nightmare. But now when sometimes marriages don't work out, right? They say half of marriages don't work out. Well, if you got a divorce, then now you're having to contact your ex-spouse for their income information just to be able to get an affordable monthly payment. These are terrible loans. The good news, I think that there's some relief on the way. I've sort of been working behind the scenes with some folks just trying to educate different policymakers. But I think that the great news that I've got to share is that there was a bill about spousal consolidation loans that passed unanimously in the Senate a couple weeks ago. I do expect that to be taken up by the House. And so I think that there's relief on the way for spousal consolidation loans. I don't want to prematurely get excited, but I am pretty excited to see something like passed unanimously in the Senate with the way things are gridlocked. That tells me that policymakers are aware of this problem and there is help on the way. Just try to be patient. I know it's hard, but that's great news. I think this is the broader message of this is when the government messes something up really bad with student loan policy, they do inevitably fix it. It just takes a while. So now here's our second question.
Hi, Travis. First of all, thank you so much for all that you and your team do. My oldest student loan dates back to 1999 when I first started college. Of course, it was FFELP loans at that time. I have worked public service for state and federal government since 2007. In February of 2007 until 2018, I worked for state government. And then 2018 to current, I worked for federal government. I have never made any payments on my student loans. I was in either the in-school deferment forbearance or the economic hardship deferment, I believe one of the years. But just in and out of all three of those. I just consolidated my six-figure student loans, my undergrad and grad last year. Since I never made any payments and we were currently in the COVID forbearance, I was in no rush to submit the PSLF form. However, now since the IDR waiver has been introduced, I have completed the PSLF application and the employer certifications for my past and current public service employment. So I have two questions, basically. First of all, am I on the right track for any possible benefits from the IDR or PSLF waiver? And the second question is, I submitted my PSLF and EC forms to the Fed Loan Servicing via their upload page on their website one day ago. So I just submitted them. My consolidated loans are with Nelnet, but since I formerly had some of my loans with Fed Loan Servicing before that consolidation, I still have access to their website. Have you encountered any of this in your consults before? Do you have any thoughts on if I should still fax these forms to Fed Loan Servicing since they technically no longer service my student loans? Thank you for everything. And again, I appreciate all that you do. Thanks, Travis.
I think this listener is doing a pretty good job already. So the first thing is she consolidated. That's great. She submitted the PSLF form. That's great. She can get some credit. So what's interesting is before the IDR waiver announcement, this person would have zero credit because she said she hadn't made any payments, right? After the IDR waiver announcement in April, they're starting to make those updates right now as we speak on people's PSLF files. So what they're doing is they're looking at, did you have a deferment? If so, was it economic hardship? That's for 2013 and after. There has to be like a certain kind of deferment. Before 2013, it can be any kind of deferment besides in school. In school, it's not going to work because just they're not giving credit for in-school deferment. But forbearances, economic hardship, all that stuff counts. This listener should have significant credit towards forgiveness, depending on how long she was in in-school deferment. So that's good. One concern is she talked about submitting stuff to FedLoan and was wondering about fax or something. So here's the problem with fax. If you fax or mail, snail mail something, it's not going to work very quickly at all. It's going to be the exact opposite of what you want to do. I would really focus on doing the thing on FedLoan, like uploading it, actually uploading the picture of it. It'll get processed a lot faster that way. If you just recently submitted that, the problem is Mohila is taking over between July and September, right? So it's a real good chance that this person's loans will move over to Mohila, and then Mohila will be in charge of verifying everything. If I were somebody, I would say apply early and often. You know, I'm just kidding a little bit, but just you've applied at FedLoan, you're waiting. When the loans move over, I would wait for the stuff to move over to Mohila, see if they have like an online portal to put things in. And I would just upload another ECF copy, the same thing you uploaded to FedLoan, just to make sure they have it. If you apply twice, is that going to get you in trouble? No, I think eventually it might even help just to make sure that they definitely got it by October 31st. Just so people know too, the stuff we're seeing is about a 3-month lag time from between when you submit something and when they actually update your file. So just if you submit in like June, July, August, September, you might be waiting until September or October before your file is updated. So now let's tackle another one.
Hello, I love your podcast, and I have a question as I navigate towards eventual forgiveness under the PSLF waiver. I have about $10,000 in student debt, and I have started working for a PSLF qualified employer since 2018. I have made about 12 months of student debt repayments under a standard repayment plan, and then the pandemic pause happened, and I have not paid since then. I just recently applied to be a part of the PSLF program and to be under IDR payments. So that's just where I'm starting now. And I've just completed that paperwork. I'm curious on how I can utilize either the PSLF waiver or IDR waiver to possibly have the 12 months of standard payments that I had made before the pandemic count towards PSLF. I'm also wondering if the 2 years towards this pandemic pause would also go towards that PSLF to start not making any payments during those times. I would love to hear your thoughts, and thank you very much.
This person's got a very modest amount of debt, and this is always what's really interesting about loan forgiveness, is it's really hard sometimes mathematically to get forgiveness if you owe a very modest amount of loans. So let's say you owe $10,000. You've been making standard payments since like 2017, 2018, and you've had the pandemic pause, which has made you not have to make payments during this time. What this person needs to do is just frankly apply. Get the ECF, the PSLF ECF form on file, because 2018 to 2022 is 4 years. So you might say, well, is it still worth going for PSLF? Like, it doesn't even make sense. But you would want to make sure that you're on the standard 10-year plan, because if you consolidate, you actually are no longer on the standard 10-year plan. You're on a, this is going to sound really stupid and confusing. It's called the standard repayment plan for consolidation loans. And it's a 10 to 30-year payment period instead of a 10-year period. So if you don't consolidate, then you have access always to the standard 10-year plan. That means if our listener had $50,000 of income and $10,000 of student loans, she could pay probably $100 a month in the standard 10-year plan, and she could do that for 6 more years and probably still have a balance left over. So like, think about it this way. You maybe started with $12,000. Your standard 10-year plan might have been $120 a month. I say 1% of the balance is a good rule of thumb for the monthly payment. Maybe your standard plan is $120 a month on $12,000 of loans. You pay a little bit of off. You had the COVID pause. You've got, let's say, $10,000 left. If you're paying $120 a month, are you going to have anything left after 6 years? If so, you can still pursue PSLF. You can still get about half, a little under half of your loans forgiven. Just shows you how complicated this stuff is. But I would say the most important thing for this listener is to get that ECF filed and get your application on file. Now let's get another listener question about grace periods.
Hey, Travis. Thanks for all your help during these chaotic student loan times. I just had a quick question for you. I'm about 10 years out of medical school as a practicing physician, the public sector. I'm on track for public service loan forgiveness, but would be past the 120 payments if the grace period during our PGY 1 year counted. I didn't make any payments, obviously, but I know deferments in 2012 count. I don't know if the grace period counts as a deferment and it's worth applying for the public service waiver. Any thoughts you have on this topic are greatly appreciated. Thanks again for all you do.
I get this question a lot. So the grace period that this listener is probably referring to is the 6 months after you graduate. They put you into basically a 6 month grace period until they ask you to make your first payment. Now, if you consolidate immediately after graduation, you waive that grace period and you start payments as soon as you start service. Usually people start July to September, right? But the problem is the grace period is not sort of a qualifying event. It's not a qualifying deferment or forbearance. It's probably not even something that you could count even if you had at least 36 months of aggregate forbearance. It probably still wouldn't count because it's kind of related to the in-school deferment. It's like kind of similar to that. I don't think that we're going to see that included based off of what I've noticed. The one thing I can tell this person is if they're that close to forgiveness already, I'm recording this in June, we're probably going to get this student loan pause kicked out to the end of the year is what we're guessing, but we'll see if that happens. I would expect it probably would be. And so that means it might not even matter because maybe your student loans are paused. Maybe you're working at the nonprofit group anyway, and maybe you just write it out from now until December and you don't even have to worry about it. Now let's get a question about different trade-offs, right? Brokerage accounts, TSP, and let's hear this one now.
Hey, SLP team. This is Jay. First, I want to thank you all for all the content you create. I myself am much more confident in my student loan planning after listening for the past year, and I've been able to help many friends and family. I just got married in May 2022 and would prefer to file married filing jointly this year to allow me and my wife to max out our Roths. However, I've been pursuing PSLF for over a year now, and we have planned to do married filing separate due to my wife's high income and no student debt. I don't have to recertify my income until August 2023, and I currently have a $0 payment from grad school returns. So do you all think I would be okay to do married filing jointly this year? And then perhaps use something other than my 2022 tax returns when I recertify next year so my wife's income isn't counted. And if this question does have a simple answer, I'd also love to hear your thoughts on how to balance TSP versus brokerage contributions. I have the ability to max out my TSP and have been doing so to lower my student loan payment as much as possible. However, I don't have much left over to put in a brokerage, so at what point should I move away from maxing out my TSP, given that I'm only getting about a $1 reduction in my student loan payment for every $10 I put in my TSP. Hope you don't mind the 2-for-1 question, though there's nothing better than a BOGO. Thanks again.
For this one, I think the reality is if you want to exclude your spouse's income, you need to be able to do married filing separately. August 2023, what tax return are you going to be using? Your 2022 tax return. Usually the problem that this creates is sometimes there's a bigger tax liability when you file separate. Also, a Roth IRA contribution is also disallowed if you file separate. So a way around that is to do a backdoor Roth IRA contribution, which you might need to be doing anyway if your income's very high. And then just realizing that you can look into the amount of extra tax you do pay when you file separate. That's a lot of things that we do in our during our consults, right? Is we're figuring out, is this extra tax penalty, is it that big of a deal compared to the much bigger reduction in student loan payments you might be getting? So I think that the answer to that is you probably do need to file separate if it's reasonable to file separate and just do backdoor Roth IRA to avoid having that conflict when you file separately. For the TSP versus brokerage account contribution, the way I would think about that is like, what are your goals? What do you need the money for? One of the things I did in my early 20s is I maxed out my Roth 401k initially, and then I switched over to doing traditional 401k, and I didn't put as much into my brokerage account. That was good, but at the same time, what I ended up wanting to do, because I didn't like my job that much, is I wanted to quit my job and quote-unquote retire and travel the world. And if I had left all my money in my retirement account, that would have maybe held me back from doing that because I would not have had as much liquid assets. Luckily, I kind of had enough of both, and I was pretty frugal. So that would be the question I would ask our listener here is, what are your goals? What is the money for? Do you love your job? If you do, then I would lean towards maxing out the TSP more. If you don't love your job, I would lean more towards a balance so you have a mix of long-term funds and shorter-term funds that you could access if you needed them in the event of you wanting to peace out or make a big job change or life change. Now we've got one finer listener question on what it's like to go through an adversarial proceeding and getting relief from a school that shut down.
I'm a Wisconsin borrower who was defrauded and fell for scamming recruiters, untrained, unlicensed financial aid advisors. And in 2014, I had to file bankruptcy. And unfortunately, we did not know that you could technically list private student loans. I became disabled in 2016 and have now four times applied, and I have literally done everything within my power to obtain not only total permanent discharge, but I also would have qualified for part of the school closure. My biggest question with this is, what happens to these loans? As you know, when you log into Navient, you can pull up your student loan information, but it doesn't go all the way back to when your loans originated. And those statuses are very important with regards to how the bill for cancellation and the settlement bill is being written.
I think this is really tough, and I just want to express sympathy with the listener. These sort of for-profit kind of fraudulent schools that it operated and took advantage of people, it really does stink. So the question is what can you do moving forward? The first thing is I would not at all talk to anybody unless I was represented by an attorney. You're going to have that attorney pay for themselves, especially if they're knowledgeable. Some of the ones that we send people to, Stanley Tate, Adam Minsky, Jay Fleischman, Josh Cohen, there's a couple others too. You want somebody who's an extremely knowledgeable student loan attorney that's representing you, right? So you don't want to be doing anything at all with interacting with the company that you're in default to if it's on private student loans. The reason why is private student loans have statute of limitations, where in certain states, if you don't acknowledge debt or if you don't basically get served a lawsuit over the debt, it's pretty much able to be completely written off depending on the state. That's why you need an attorney, because you don't, I mean, I wouldn't know if something, certain kinds of communications reset statute of limitations or not. For federal student loans, luckily it's a lot easier. I would just make sure they're direct loans. I would make sure that you have it set up for some sort of income-driven repayment. You've applied to borrower defense to repayment. It seems like with Corinthian College's debt all getting wiped away, that a lot of these other kinds of debts might get wiped away too. What generally happens with these for-profit schools is there's this thing called, I think it's the 90-10 rule, where 90%, no more than 90% of your financing can come through federal student loans. So a lot of these programs would just come up with 10% loans that were almost expected to lose 50% of their value, and they would kind of take them on their own balance sheet. And it was just sort of like almost like fake financing, I feel like, because they just did it so they could get federal student loans in the first place. And then they didn't have to worry about that last 10% defaulting completely and being worth nothing, because they would just be able to make it all up by charging the taxpayer. So sorry you're going through that, but just get good help in your corner. By the way, if you want to ask a question for our show, I love getting questions from listeners. studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. Leave your question and we might feature it on an upcoming show. And now I want to talk about something called the June 30th sales tactic. I'm going to talk mostly to medical professionals with this, but it does apply to everybody. So one of my pandemic projects was opening up an insurance agency in all 50 states. The way I kind of thought about this is we want to get you the best deals on absolutely everything we possibly can. So my initial thought was to do what we did for student loan refinancing to the insurance marketplace, right? What I mean by that is student loan refinancing, you get all these commissions and they're all hidden. Nobody knows what people are getting paid. So my thought was, okay, well, we're going to rebate a lot of cash back to the listener, or, to the customer, which is you. Initially, we were able to do 500, but we've negotiated these up to 1,000. So I thought, wow, this is great. We're getting people better deals than even if they apply directly. Could we maybe open up an insurance agency and rebate commissions? Could we give back a lot of our commission that we earn on disability insurance or term life insurance and thereby get better pricing for our audience? So that was my idea. And I got the agency set up. I got myself licensed in all 50 states. It really took a massive amount of effort. So SLP Insurance LLC is our insurance agency that's affiliated with Student Loan Planner. And here's what the funny thing that I discovered. It's like illegal to rebate commissions. This is like the best sweetheart deal, in my opinion, in the world. If you're an insurance agent or insurance agency, literally like state law and regulations make it like virtually a crime to reduce your price that you'll accept for doing a disability or term life insurance policy. I guess the idea is to not steer people into one company or one product that might be worse for them than the other. But I think this is like really anti-competitive, honestly, because it's just sort of like price fixing is what it is, in my opinion. Like, you're going to have these high commissions with no way around it. If I'm a consumer and I go direct to the insurance agency, I'm going to pay the commission basically anyway, or I'm going to pay the same pricing anyway. Literally, there's like no incentive for a consumer to not work with a knowledgeable agent for term life and own occupation, own specialty disability insurance, because you're essentially forced into paying a commission, which I really dislike. I think it's like a bad business model, in my opinion, but we have to operate with the world we're given. So then I thought, okay, if I'm banned legally from giving any kind of rebates whatsoever, then how could we add value in this space? And so one of the things I thought we could do is sort of debunk some of the sales things that you get pitched. I'm going to talk about two different kinds of policies. So the first policy I'm going to talk about is own occupation, own specialty disability insurance. That's mostly going to apply to, you know, physicians, dentists, veterinarians, CRNAs, podiatrists, medical folks, right? Pharmacists, very high income attorneys. And then we're going to talk about term life, which is mostly a product for if you are a current or future parent, is really what that's for. Let's talk about what is the June 30th scare tactic or June 30th sales tactic. So a lot of insurance agents will give talks, lunch and learns, right? For your residency program, your medical school, dental school program, and they're all wanting to talk about disability insurance. Why is that? So from a commission's perspective, you could probably make anywhere from 50% to 100% of the first year's premiums on a disability insurance policy. So in other words, it's very, very lucrative. Think about if you're paying $200 a month, that's $2,400 a year. An insurance agent might be able to capture $1,200 to $2,400 as their commission. That turns every dental student or medical student into a massive revenue source that they can get in front of enough people. What you need to do, insurance is not generally bought, it's sold. So you have to come up with strategies, sales tactics, if you will, for people to buy it. Now, I'm not at all saying bad things about the insurance industry. I think it's very important. I have insurance policies in place, right? But there is certainly tactics that people use to try to get people to take action. And one of these tactics is to tell you that you've got to apply in June 30th, a couple days probably after you're listening to this. You've got to apply by June 30th or you risk giving up all of your discounts. Well, there's one problem there. That's not true. You actually have, with some companies, until September 30th to get your residency or fellowship discount. And some companies, you can even wait until December. Now, why is that a bad idea? The reason it's a bad idea is because if you waited until the end of September to apply, you might not be able to get that application fully submitted in time to get that residency pricing, and then you would have cost yourself thousands of dollars a year. The idea here is who needs to buy disability insurance? It's people that have borrowed six figures for a typically medical profession or other high-income profession where if they lost their income, you might lose your house. That would be the simple way that I could explain it. Let's think about what is the way that most people buy disability insurance, that most people do not buy it. And here's the reality. Social Security disability covers all of us. So if you're listening to this, you're probably covered by Social Security disability. The problem is the average benefit is only about $1,200 a month from Social Security disability. So what does that mean? Most people are relying on their spouse's income, their friends, their family, savings. You might have a policy through work, or maybe you just have a really high risk tolerance. So what does disability insurance do exactly? There's something called an elimination period, which is also known as a waiting period, and you have to wait for whatever that elimination period is before your benefits kick in. Generally speaking, disability insurance payments will last until 65 or until you're no longer disabled. It usually covers about 60% of your earnings, or it can cover up to that. Here's a little tidbit of knowledge. If you have an employer policy, they're going to deduct the premiums. The money paid to you will be taxable. If you pay the premiums and the money that comes to you if you're disabled is tax-free. For own occupation, own specialty coverage, you can purchase add-ons, things like cost of living adjustments, partial replacement of incomes, and you also can purchase riders for something called an own occupation clause. What is disability insurance? Why would somebody want it, even though it sounds like as interesting as getting a, I don't know, a root canal, honestly? Like, it doesn't sound very fun, right? It's absolutely necessary because the reality is it's actually a lot more likely that you will become temporarily probably temporarily disabled is what's most likely than something really catastrophic, right? Like you passing away or becoming a quadriplegic. Thank goodness that those are very low probability events for all of us. What is a lot more likely is that you're out of commission for a year due to a big problem with your back or some temporary illness that you experience, right? Those are things that happen to all of us. Can you self-insure against that? Are your assets and incomes sources good enough that that's not going to be something that you need to worry about. For most people, you need to worry about it. You know, most people buy nice houses. Can you make your mortgage payment and put food on the table if something happened to your income? This is one of the really good things, I think, about being a highly educated professional is you have the ability to ensure that income where you don't have to worry about things like other people take risks on, right? The office worker is probably just taking that full-on risk that if they get hit by a bus and become paralyzed, they're going to get some amount of income from Social Security disability. Maybe Medicare might cover, or Medicare, Medicaid might cover their medical expenses, but they're just kind of out of luck. I think that this is something that everybody needs to have. For medical professionals, you really need to have something called own occupation. So what this is a clause in your policy that says if you can no longer do the profession that you trained for, and it needs to also probably say the specialty that you trained for, the language needs to be really strong so that if somebody T-bones you they blow through a stop sign, they T-bone you, you break your hand where you can't quite hold the instrument that you need to do your procedures the way you used to, and that significantly impairs your income, that policy would pay out. What you don't want is an any occupation disability clause where it's like, oh, well, guess what? You can still be a medical sales rep. I think that a lot of people would be really upset if that was the option that they had to do, right? So you want a policy that does cover own specialty coverage in your occupational definition. Now, this is just some more information about disability insurance. One of the reasons, by the way, we're talking about this is because the end of June/early July is like the busiest time of year all year for people buying disability insurance because people graduate residency, they graduate fellowship, they might graduate dental or medical school. And it's just a time when a lot of people have the time to think about this. The goal is that you think about it once and get it over with and then not have to worry about it again. So there's 6 big companies that offer disability insurance. There's another one that in my opinion, doesn't really offer true own occupation coverage. So I'm going to leave them out. And occasionally you'll see a group disability policy that's underwritten by yet another company. But really, it's really more like 4 companies are the ones that provide most of the coverage in this space. Now, one of the things that I learned when we were launching our own ability to give people disability insurance quotes is that you can sometimes get much better pricing through something called a guaranteed standard issue policy, which is something that your residency program or your hospital or your school might have a deal with a particular insurance company where they will give you a quote with no medical exam. And if you have any medical problem at all, then that's a really smart policy to take advantage of. So one of the things we do is, since I was banned from giving rebates, since that's like illegal, what are the ways can SLP provide value in this space? Well, one of the things our agents do is they look for your residency program or your hospital or your school to make sure that you don't have a better discount or a better underwriting available through, you know, your program that you can go through for school or for your training program. And a lot of times we find better discounts through those programs and then our agency would make nothing. And that's okay. That's kind of like my model was like, okay, well, what is the best thing for people on this annoying thing that they need? And then can we do this in a better, more ethical way than in a lot of other places? And I think the answer is yes, because you might find that one particular company has like got this deep relationship with your residency program where you can get 35% off pricing for retail, right? So that's the kind of stuff that we see with comparison shopping. It's really not like talking to multiple brokers because pretty much all the brokers are probably going to have mostly the same pricing. It's really like comparing a broker that does a lot of volume with whatever you can get through your job or your school, which is something that we do for folks. So one thing I am kind of excited to share is we've got sort of group rates with at least a couple companies where we're getting 10 to 15% off, up to 10 to 15% off of the retail price because of the volume. We've sent quite a lot of volume through Student Loan Planner to insurance companies through our agency. So that's kind of a cool thing. Let's talk about a few riders for policies so that you know what these mean. Own occupation, that was one of the big ones that you need to have. Another couple riders, residual benefits rider. So this is something that, let's say you have a back problem and you can only work 2 days a week instead of 5. A residual benefit rider would make up that lost income. Whereas if you don't have that rider, you've got to be totally disabled, not able to work at all. And then you can't quite make your mortgage payment, so you're stuck, right? So the residual benefit rider is important. There's, you know, the catastrophic rider that you should get because it's very cheap. That pays you a little bit extra if you have some sort of catastrophic disability. There's a future increase rider where you can buy additional coverage in the future without a medical exam. That's a must purchase. If you're buying a policy in residency where your income is going to be much higher in the future, you definitely want to buy that because you don't want to have to get re-underwritten in case something bad does happen. You want to be able to just buy a lot more additional coverage without any kind of medical underwriting. And then there's a couple other riders that people present to you. There's the cost of living rider, and then there's the student loan rider. I probably would get the cost of living rider. You might as well. The student loan rider is something that I would only buy if you are planning to refinance your loans. If you want to have private student loans, then having the student loan rider is really helpful because for a very cheap price, they'll pay up to, usually it's up to $2,500 a month towards your student loans. If you have federal student loans, that rider is totally unnecessary because your loan payments would drop because your income would fall. And if you were totally and permanently disabled, the loans would be forgiven tax-free anyway. The cost of disability insurance is just a lot more than other kinds of insurance policies. The reason is because it's a huge risk the insurance company is taking. So in training, you know, your cost could be anywhere from usually like $100 to $300 a month. And you might say, I don't have that kind of money right now. Well, you probably need to make room for that, at least to some degree. You can play around with the riders, the elimination period. You can move things around on insurance policies where you're getting into something that's affordable in your budget, and then you can always add on a supplemental policy later. Now, there's also association policies. The one thing that I can say about the workplace and the association policies is generally the language in these insurance policies is not very good. The policy language might be kind of lousy. They might exclude a lot of things. They might only cover up to a capped amount of benefits. One of our clients knew they had coverage through work, but he didn't know exactly what it was. Once he looked, we found, and we actually, our agent looked at it for him, he only had $5,000 in coverage and it was taxable income. His mortgage payment was like $4,000 a month. So in other words, like he wouldn't even have enough money to pay his mortgage with his disability insurance policy through work. So what we did is we just helped him get a supplemental policy in place for a few thousand a month more than that so that both policies would pay out if he was disabled. Now he can afford the mortgage. Now he can afford to put food on the table without having to worry. So the premiums really depend on a whole lot of things. This is kind of an interesting, I didn't know this before starting the agency, but certain states will have better policies. Like one state might mandate unisex pricing and another state might allow gender discrimination based on price. If you are a female physician moving to a state that mandates unisex pricing, you might wait to submit the policy under the new state because your pricing might be a lot better. The converse is true if you're a male. Like say you're a male in a state that allows gender discrimination pricing, moving to a state that doesn't allow it, well, you would want to submit the policy before you move so that you can get the cheaper rate locked in. These are just things that we obviously just try to find people the best deal, right? It's kind of weird that there's so much nuance in this world, but the good news is I think that we could really find everybody the coverage that they need in the disability insurance space. If you want to check out your disability insurance rates, if you want to hear back from us on that, studentloanplanner.com/DI, not D-I-E, that'd be bad, not that URL, studentloanplanner.com/DI, like disability insurance. And there's a quote form at the top of the page. If you're a graduating resident or fellow, if you're a graduating medical or dental student, if you are a physician or dentist or CRNA or podiatrist or pharmacist or whatever who's been in practice for a few years, or you already have disability insurance and you would just really appreciate a second set of eyes just to make sure that, yeah, you do have good coverage, you can just go to studentloanplanner.com/DI. You can also find it in the recommended section on our website. If you go on studentloanplanner.com in the menu, you'll see recommended. You'll see a dropdown of the, you know, the disability insurance stuff where you can get that examined. So I just thought I'd mention that because a lot of you are going to get hit up really, really hard in the next couple of days with the scare tactic of you got to apply right now or else you're screwed. You'll lose all your discounts for your disability insurance. That's not the case, right? But definitely do it in the next couple weeks because if you want to get that submitted and fully underwritten so you're not cutting it close, it's the same kind of thing like the PSLF waiver. I'm super worried for the people that contact us October 15th. And we have 2 weeks to try to turn around and get them applied for and certified for PSLF and consolidated and all that stuff. It's already giving me stress. So please don't put yourself in that situation because, you know, the consequence is you don't get the coverage you need. So you're taking a huge risk in that regard. And the second risk is that, you know, you might risk losing the thousands of dollars a year in residency or fellowship discounts that you could qualify for potentially. I want to briefly talk about term life because I think that's important too. Just real quick about term life insurance. Term life is something that's kind of weird, right? You think, oh, I'm not going to die. Well, unfortunately, none of us can know that, including myself. And what I ended up doing, I'll just tell you what I did with term life. And by the way, with disability insurance, we have a policy for my wife because she's a surgeon and we don't really need it at this point, but it's the kind of thing that I want to be extra financially secure before we cancel it, because also I think it's important for her to have her own policy just in general, right? Just for her own independent status for me, if there was ever a reason she wanted to leave me or something. At least she has her disability insurance place. I don't know. Hopefully she's not listening to this. So for life insurance, who needs that? This is something that if you're not financially independent yet, you need term life insurance for sure. And you almost surely don't have what you need through work. What I mean by that is term life through work is often capped at either $50,000 or 2x your salary. That's a problem. It's a real problem. Say you make $100,000 as a pharmacist and you just bought your new house, $600,000 is what you spent because of the terrible housing market. So now you get hit by a bus and your family's going to get $200,000 and your spouse is a teacher and they're supposed to stay in that house and make and also have a low five-figure bill for funeral expenses. It's very unpleasant to think about. I'll grant you that. I mean, I don't even have my end-of-life directives in place yet, I guess, because it's, you know, a hypocrite. I don't practice what I preach, right? No, I think it's really just because there's certain things that are low probability, and a lot of us just put off the low probability events because we're not worried about it. I will say, though, that the term life stuff is the kind of thing where there would be a whole lot of terrible things my wife would have to think through and deal with if I got hit by the bus, but at least she wouldn't have to worry about finances because I've taken care of my family for that. And initially, I started off with $1,000,000 20-year term. I think I was paying like $40 a month. I just used one company that searched that one company's premiums, right? And what I found is I could triple my coverage for only like double the cost. Instead of $40 a month, I'd pay $80 a month, but I would get 3x the coverage. And I thought that was a really good deal. I kind of messed up. I didn't really do a good job comparison shopping for term life. And I started shopping like the second we found out we were pregnant. I was like, oh, shoot, I should have had that in place. I think I actually might have gotten it in place before we started trying. But my thought process on that is get 10x your coverage. So your work has probably 2x your salary. So for a privately bought policy, you could either just do 10x to make it easy, or you could get 8x because you've already got 2x through work and that 2 plus 8 is 10. In terms of like searching for this, you could do studentloanplanner.com/life, L-I-F-E. Luckily, there's no weird URLs that you could spell with that, I guess. So studentloanplanner.com/life, and you can quickly fill that out and get a quote for a term life quote. And I think it's going to be really cheap. So a lot of times we see people with like whole life policies or universal life policies that were sold to them by a high commission agent. Sometimes it makes sense to keep those in place, but convert them to term instead of keeping the whole life premium so you can spend a lot less and put the money into other things. Sometimes you can replace that policy because it's just a bad, lousy policy. So for me, I replaced my term policy, even though it was like really cheap. It was just like unnecessarily expensive compared to what I could get. I would just say if you are at all thinking about family planning kind of stuff, growing your family, having extra kids, starting to have kids, if you haven't thought about this, get this in place. One of my friends has got a very kind of awkward joke that it's kind of a bad joke, but it's sort of like, if you don't buy term life insurance, tell your spouse not to send me your GoFundMe link if something happens to you. It's kind of weird, but I think it's kind of true, right? It's like, this is an opportunity for you to protect your family. And you only do it if you have people depending on your income. So this is mostly people that have a spouse, a big mortgage, kids that need to have college funds paid for if something happens to you, kids that need to have all of their summer camp and those kind of expenses prepaid and account for them. And it's super cheap, right? So I have millions of coverage for $80 a month. Not everybody's necessarily going to get that cheap of a price. Maybe you're older than me. Maybe you're younger than me. Maybe you get better pricing, right? But I think the deal is if you're thinking about what do I need coverage-wise, disability insurance is going to be maybe a few hundred a month at most. Term life should probably be no more than like 100 to 200 a month, but it might be like 40 to 50, 60 a month, something like that. Anyways, studentloanplanner.com/life. Also, if you want, if you go to our recommended page, we can also kind of connect you with our in-house agents if you want a little bit more sort of high touch experience for getting a really good customer service experience for your term life quote. Just reach out to us at help@studentloanplanner.com. What I mean by that is you're going to pay the same commission. If you go through an online kind of brokerage kind of thing, you're going to pay the same commission anyway. I would probably suggest that if you're trying to get a policy in place, it's less than $1 million. But if you want to get term of like 2 million or 3 million or 4 or 5 million, like a really large policy, that's when it really pays, I think, to have an expert the same people that work under an occupation disability insurance quotes can do more of a like a high touch experience to get you a better customer application experience is what I'm, I guess, trying to say with submitting things. Maybe you can find a no underwriting policy. Maybe you can submit things to extra insurance companies that might not be present on the online sort of search engines that are out there. If you want to just check your own quotes, studentloanplanner.com/life, or send us an email, help@studentloanplanner.com, and we can put you in touch with our own agents. Finally, you know, I just want to suggest get these policies in place if you need them. Hopefully, if you already have them in place, you've already tuned me out. Great, you got what you need. But if you don't have what you need, because you're thinking about insurance all at once, because you're finishing up a training program, or you're finishing up school, studentloanplanner.com/DI for disability insurance quotes, studentloanplanner.com/life for life insurance quotes. And I have to say, legal stuff, insurance services provided by SLP Insurance LLC in New York and California, where SLP Professionals Insurance Agency LLC. And I just really hope you get the coverage you need. And also, we're doing a ton of student loan plans right now. You can obviously go book a plan, studentloanplanner.com/book for that. I just hope you get your dreams accomplished. Thank you to everybody that bought the financial planning course. We've got a really awesome group of people that have signed up for that. Just continue making you the focus. The goal here is to have you live your best life so that you're not burdened, so that you don't feel crushing anxiety from your student loans. And I wanted to reorient your mind and your thinking towards what are my goals, what are my dreams, how do I achieve those a lot faster? And all these financial planning tools, insurance, student loan plans, investing, TSPs, 401ks, brokerages, Roth IRAs, it's all a tool, right? The purpose is, what is the goal we're building for? Not the toolbox. The toolbox is something you use to get you to your goals. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Hope you have a great week. And this is Travis from Student Loan Planner Podcast signing off.